This past week, I heard an excellent illustration from who I believe to be one of the greatest living Bible scholars. His name is Don Carson. And this illustration is from a sermon that he preached back in 2016. The sermon illustration has to do with when God commanded the Israelites to paint their doorposts with the blood of the Passover lamb. Did so in order to be saved from the angel of death who was passing over that evening. This is Don Carson's illustration. He says, picture two Jews by the name of Smith and Brown. Remarkably Jewish names, he says. The day before the first Passover, they're having a little discussion in the land of Goshen. And Smith says to Brown, boy, are you a little nervous about what's going to happen tonight? And Brown says, well, God told us what to do through his servant Moses. You don't have to be nervous. Haven't you slaughtered the lamb and daubed the doorposts with the blood? Put blood on the lintel? Haven't you done that? You're all ready and packed to go, right? You're going to eat your whole Passover meal with your family, right? Smith says, of course I've done all that. I'm not stupid. But it's still pretty scary when you think of all the things that have happened around here recently. You know, the flies and the river turning to blood. It's pretty awful. And now there's a threat of the firstborn being killed, you know. It's all right for you. You've got three sons. I've only got one. And I love my Charlie. And the angel of death is passing through tonight. I know what God says. I put the blood there. But it's pretty scary. I'll be glad when this night is over. And the other one responds, bring it on. I trust the promises of God. Well, that night, the angel of death swept through the land. And here's the question that Carson raises. Which one of those two, Smith and Brown, lost his son? Neither. You're right, Brianna. The answer is neither. Neither lost their son. Because death does not pass over them on the ground of the intensity or the clarity of the faith exercised, but only on the ground of the blood of the Lamb. That is what silences the accuser. We overcome him, Carson says, by the blood of the Lamb. There is the ground of all human assurance before God. There is the ground of our faith. And Carson concludes with this, it is not the intensity of our faith, but the object of our faith that saves. In many ways, this is what our passage this morning is about. It's about faith and unbelief. And the question I want you thinking about as we're studying Mark 9 this morning is not how strong is your faith. That's not the question that I want you to ask this morning. Question I want you to ask is, how strong is the object of your faith? How strong is what you have put your faith in? That's the question I want before us this morning. I invite you to open your Bibles this morning to Mark chapter 9, where we're going to be in verses 14 through 29. Mark chapter 9, verses 14 through 29. The gospel writer Mark writes under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and scribes arguing with them. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. And he asked them, what are you arguing about with them? And someone from the crowd answered him, teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down. And he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able. And he answered them, O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me. And they brought the boy to him. When the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked his father, how long has this been happening to him? He said, from childhood. It is often cast him into fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. And Jesus said to him, if you can, all things are possible for one who believes. Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, I believe, help my unbelief. When Jesus saw a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, you mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. After crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, he is dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. When he had entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, why could we not cast it out? And he said to them, this kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer. Well, I've broken this passage down into two sections this morning. If you're taking notes, these are the two points of my sermon. First, we see that God rebukes faithlessness. God rebukes faithlessness in verses 14 through 19. But then secondly, we see that God works through faith, even imperfect faith. We see that in verses 20 through 29. God works through faith, even imperfect faith. But first, we see that God rebukes faithlessness. Everybody look with me at verse 14. Mark writes, when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around him and scribes arguing with them. So this is just after Jesus and the three disciples were up on the Mount of Transfiguration. Surely a mountaintop experience if there ever was one. And these three disciples and Jesus come down and they meet the other nine. When they meet them, they encounter a situation. In many ways, it's the exact opposite of the situation that they had just experienced on the mountain with Jesus. Down from the mountain, they encounter an argument between the other disciples and the scribes, Mark says, the Jewish leaders who have been everywhere opposing Jesus' ministry. Well, not only this, but a crowd has gathered around to watch, kind of like a first century boxing match. They want to see who the winner's going to be. We don't yet know what they're arguing about, but for now, just note the juxtaposition here. Much like what Moses experienced coming down from Mount Sinai after having met with God. After being with God for 40 days and 40 nights, Moses comes down to what? Well, you just read about. A camp full of wicked idolatry and rebellion and faithlessness. And now, here in Jesus' life, after being with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration, the three disciples come down with Jesus, and what do they see? A crowd full of rebellion and faithlessness. Well, what's all the fuss about here? Look with me at the next verse, verse 15. Immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. And he asked them, what are you arguing about with them? So when the crowd sees Jesus, they immediately recognize him. And their reaction hints that Jesus has something to do with the argument that's taking place. Well, it's not exactly clear from the text who Jesus asked this question to in verse 16. He says, what are you arguing about with them? Is that to the disciples or the scribes? The parties of the argument. I think it's likely that Jesus is actually asking the scribes who are there harassing the disciples. Jesus has experienced this already in his ministry. And so he asks the scribes, what are you arguing about with them? Them being his disciples. The scribes, they've been here before. They know what happens when they cross swords with Jesus. They always lose. So notice, nobody answers. The scribes don't answer. The disciples don't answer. They have to wait until somebody else speaks up in verse 17. And someone from the crowd answered him, teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him down and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out and they were not able. Well, there's a lot here in this answer from this desperate father, in both what he clearly states and also what's implied from this statement. First, what we know. There's a father whose son has a demon that makes him unable to speak. It's been oppressing him physically. It's physically harming him. And this father, concerned for his son, has brought his son to Jesus, the one that he has heard so much about, with the power over the demons for deliverance. But he tries to find Jesus, and Jesus is not to be found. Where's Jesus? He's up on the Mount of Transfiguration with his three disciples. So the next best thing is bringing his son to his disciples, these that have been with Jesus. So he brings his son to the disciples, the nine who were left down from the mountain, and they can't help. They can't cast out the demon. So now we can make a few inferences. This is what has set off the argument. The nine disciples that are left behind, they had tried to cast out the demon, and they were unsuccessful. Well, why did they try? If you remember back in Mark chapter 3, verses 13 through 14, we read about when Jesus actually commissioned the disciples, the 12 apostles, and he gave them power over the demons. Here's what Mark writes in Mark 3, 13 and 14. And Jesus went up on the mountain and called to him those whom he desired, and they came to him. And he appointed 12, whom he also named apostles, so that they might be with him, and he might send them out to preach and have authority to cast out demons. So he's already given them the authority to cast out demons. Not only had they just received this authority and power, they had actually already exercised it successfully in Mark's gospel. In Mark chapter 6, verse 7, we read that Jesus called the 12 and began to send them out two by two and gave them authority over the unclean spirits. Then in verse 13, and they cast out many demons and anointed with oil many who were sick and healed them. So these disciples have already cast out demons. It's not unreasonable for them to have tried to cast out the demon from this man's son. But for reasons we're going to find out, they were unable to do so. And this public failure had riled up the scribes. They were arguing with the disciples. Can you imagine the PR windfall this must have been for the scribes? Jesus is MIA. He's on the mountain. His other nine disciples try to do a public miracle, and they fail. So what do the scribes do? They're there to pounce. They try to undermine Jesus and his ministry. Probably a lot of jeering going on in this crowd. Probably a lot of casting of doubts on previous miracles and ministry successes by these disciples and even Jesus, who can't fend for himself. He's gone. And the crowd is eating it up. But now Jesus is back. And the scribes have shut up. And so he asks the question. The scribes don't answer. The father answers. And Jesus can only shake his head at the situation. Look at Jesus' response in verse 19. He answered them, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." These are pretty hard words from Jesus. Who are they addressed to? I think primarily they're addressed to the scribes. Why do I say that? Well, this is actually similar language that Jesus had used before in Mark 8:12 when the Pharisees demanded a sign from him. You remember that? Verse 11, the Pharisees came and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and said, "Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation." It was right after this that Jesus warns the disciples against what he calls the leaven of the Pharisees. It's the faithlessness of the Pharisees. With this picture of leaven, Jesus is warning that the faithlessness and the unbelief of the Pharisees and the scribes, it's actually contagious. It can cause you to deny and be ashamed of Jesus. Later on in Mark 8:38, Jesus warns his disciples of this faithlessness. He ties it to this adulterous and sinful generation. Listen to Mark 8:38. Jesus says, "For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." So that's why I believe that Jesus' hard words here in Mark 9:19, they're primarily directed to the scribes. He says, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you?" Their resistance and faithlessness is beginning to wear on Jesus. And Jesus is wondering aloud how much longer he's going to be able to endure such bold-faced opposition to God and his work. But I think that Jesus' words also have implications for the disciples and the crowd. Think about it. Jesus had only been gone a few days, and already the nine disciples had lost the ability to cast out demons. Already the scribes had gained the upper hand in an argument, and the crowd already was being swayed. Jesus sees faithlessness and he rebukes it. Why? Because faithlessness is sin. Faithlessness is sin. Paul tells us this in Romans 14:23. He says, "For whatever does not proceed from faith is sin." It's a bleak rebuke. But thanks be to God, there is still hope even in the midst of such faithlessness. Because wherever there is true faith, no matter how small, no matter how puny, wherever there is true faith, God is still at work. It's our second point this morning. God works through faith, even imperfect faith. Look with me at verse 20. "And they brought the boy to him. When the Spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth." So they bring the demon-possessed boy to Jesus, and the demon's reaction is immediate. It throws the boy down, and the boy convulses in pain. It would have been very hard to watch this happening, this young boy. At this point in the story, it seems like the demon is the only one who sees things clearly. He's scared. He knows what's going to happen. See, the demon has spiritual sight, and with that spiritual sight, it can see that Jesus, the Son of God, is here. And things are not going to go well for that demon in the presence of the Lord of the universe. The scribes may be in denial. The nine disciples might feel defeated. The father may feel helpless. But the demon sees clearly. The Son of God is here on the scene. Look with me at verse 21. "And Jesus asked his father, 'How long has this been happening to him?' He said, 'From childhood. It has often cast him into fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us.'" You can almost hear the pain and the desperation in this man's voice. Here we learn that this demon-possessed boy is not a new thing, a new reality in the son's life. It's been with him for a long, long time, from childhood, he says. This spiritual stronghold is deep-seated. Perhaps that's the reason why the disciples have such a hard time. But the demon has one goal in mind with this possession. The father says it in verse 22. "It has often cast him into fire and into water." Why? "To destroy him." This is the devil and his minions' mission. John 10:10. "The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy." That's what this demon's doing. Killing and destroying. But Jesus doesn't stop there in John 10:10. He says, "I came that they may have life and have it abundantly." Note the father's feeble ask at the end of verse 22. What does he say? "But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." Did you catch that? He says, "If you can do anything." It's part of the problem here. The father has not quite realized the true identity of the one standing there before him. If you can do anything. That's not the question, is it? Can Jesus do anything? course. He's God. This explains Jesus' response in verse 23. He says to him, if you can, all things are possible for one who believes. Some translations, they render Jesus' reply this way. If you can believe, all things are possible for the one who believes. They supply that word belief in there. Translation like the one I'm reading from, the ESV, say, if you can, as if Jesus is repeating the words back to the Father to show him the error in his question. But either way, Jesus includes this amazing statement in his response. He says, all things are possible for one who believes. We could unpack this truth in a syllogism. Here it is. The one who believes trusts God. God can do anything. Therefore, the one who believes trusts God who can do anything. That's what Jesus is saying. In other words, it's not a statement about the believer's power and ability. It's a statement about the believer's God and God's power and ability. This is the meaning of Jesus' words when he says all things are possible for the one who believes. The Bible says the same thing in another way in Romans 8:31. Paul says, if God is for us, who or what can be against us? See, that's the corollary of all things are possible. If God is for us, who can be against us? You see, the problem facing the Father and His Son was not a lack of power or ability on God's part. No, it's a lack of faith. Faced with his faithlessness at the end of his rope, the Father realizes his error, and he offers up a prayer of desperation out of the only faith that he could muster. Look with me at verse 24. Immediately, the father of the child cried out and said, I believe. Help my unbelief. I called this a prayer because it's directed at Jesus, and Jesus is God. Look at the simplicity of this prayer. He says, I believe, help my unbelief. This father knows and he confesses his lack of faith. He knows he's not adequate enough here. Yet he still believes that Jesus can help. You see, he asks Jesus for help there. Help my unbelief. Brothers and sisters, friends, this is the nature of true faith. It doesn't matter the size of your faith. It doesn't matter the age of your faith. It doesn't matter the strength of your faith. What then matters? What matters is the object of your faith. It matters that the object of your faith is God, Jesus, and His power to save. You see, the Father does not have perfect faith. He knows that. He confesses it to Jesus, his faith's weakness. Yet he's come to the right place, and he's just now put his faith in the right object, Jesus, asking him for help. And look what happens next in verse 25. When Jesus saw the crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, you mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him, never enter him again. And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, he is dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. Jesus saves where there's faith. Where there's faith, Jesus saves. Even if the faith is weak or frail or new or old or rich or poor, Jesus saves where there's faith. You see, faith is faith in God's eyes. Our job is to pray the same prayer that the Father prays. I believe, help my unbelief. It's not that we're content when there's lingering doubts, when there's lingering unbeliefs. We want God to help us to believe. We know that God helps us in our faith. And we know that we need God to help us in our faith. So we pray, I believe God, rid me, help me with my unbelief. The great English preacher Charles Spurgeon, he wrote this about this exchange between the Father and Jesus. He says this, "Now there was an if in the question, but the poor trembling Father had put the if in the wrong place. Jesus Christ, therefore, without commanding him to retract the if, kindly puts it in its legitimate position. Nay, verily, he seemed to say, there should be no if about my power, nor concerning my willingness. The if lies somewhere else. If thou canst believe, all things are possible to him that believe." The man's trust was strengthened. He offered a humble prayer for an increase of faith, and instantly Jesus spoke the word, the devil was cast out with an injunction never to return. Spurgeon says there's a lesson here which we need to learn. We, like this man, often see that there is an if somewhere, but we perpetually blundering by putting it in the wrong place. If Jesus can help me, if he can make me successful, nay, if you can believe, he both can and will. You have misplaced your if. If you can confidently trust, even as all things are possible to Christ, so shall all things be possible to you. Faith standeth in God's power and is robed in God's majesty. It weareth the royal apparel and rideth on the king's horse, for it is the grace which the king delighteth to honor. Spurgeon concludes, girding itself with the glorious might of the all-working Spirit, it becomes, in the omnipotence of God, mighty to do, to dare, and to suffer. All things without limit are possible to him that believeth. What an amazing truth. Finally, after the crowd dispersed, the disciples were left alone, and Jesus, he has a moment to teach them in verse 28 and 29. Mark writes, "When he had entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, 'Why could we not cast it out?' And he said to them, 'This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer.'" If you read this account in Matthew's gospel, you'll see that Jesus says something slightly different there. Jesus answered them this question, telling them that the problem was their lack of faith. Here in Mark, Jesus says the problem is their lack of prayer. I don't think these are saying two different things here. Think about it. What is prayer? It's a recognition that God has the power and ability to save, and then asking him to come to our rescue. What is faith? It's a recognition that God has the power and the ability to save, and then trusting him to come to our rescue. That's why prayer is the most basic instinct of faith. Corollary, then, is that prayerlessness, lack of prayer, is one of the greatest indications of faithlessness. In conclusion, our passage teaches us this morning that God rebukes faithlessness, but God works through faith, even imperfect faith. Jesus' answer in verse 29 reminds me of a story from Charles Spurgeon's life. Charles Spurgeon, who I quoted earlier in the sermon. He's known as the Prince of Preachers. They think he's probably one of the greatest preachers that ever lived. He pastored a Baptist church in London called the Metropolitan Tabernacle. It's not an overstatement to say that literally thousands came to Christ through his preaching ministry. Not only that, but literally tens of thousands would hear him every week to preach. It's a lot of people. a lot of people. What was his secret? Well, people would actually come to the Metropolitan Tabernacle and ask him that. Spurgeon, what are you doing here? Why are all these people listening to you? How do you have so much success in bringing all these people to Christ? When people would come, Spurgeon, he would take them downstairs to his church's basement. What was down there? Well, down there, every single week, before and after and during the service, there were literally hundreds of people on their knees praying. Praying. Spurgeon called these gatherings the boiler room, because back then, where the energy of a building came from was the boiler room. So he's saying, this is the boiler room. This is what's driving the ministry of the church, is those people on their knees praying that God would work. Spurgeon's success was not owing to anything of his own doing. It was owing to God and the people asking God to work in faith. Spurgeon's success was due to prayer, because prayer is the language of faith, the language of the faithful. We want to bless the ministry here at First Baptist Church of Mays, don't we? Let's be then fervent in prayer as we depend on God in faith. No matter the size or strength of your faith, if you've got faith, you can pray and ask the God of the universe to do anything. I think we should start with this prayer. I believe, help my unbelief.